Well, good morning, everybody, and Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
We're going to finish up my book report, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. We have been going through the six chapters of crimes, and of course we've been all the way through. We did evil last week, and going to finish up today with science. It's blinded me with science, whatever. Anyway, let's dig in here. He titles this chapter with something that he says a lot in the debates that he does, and when he goes to these universities and does these presentations and things, and that is that science doesn't say anything. You know, we hear this, well, science says this and that. Well, science doesn't say anything. Scientists do, which when you think about it is really very true, isn't it? Scientists gather data, but then they have to interpret that data, right? Science doesn't interpret its own data. The scientists do. And so the chapter title page here says, to say that a scientist can disprove the existence of God is like saying a mechanic can disprove the existence of Henry Ford. While there is certainly evidence from science to support theism, the most important point for this chapter is not that science supports theism, but that theism supports science. In other words, theism makes doing science possible. Turek started this chapter with a modern example of how science itself doesn't interpret the data. Some of us obviously remember the O.J. Simpson trial and things. There's actually some people here that didn't live through that and didn't go through that whole debacle. But for all you youngins, cable TV basically televised the whole entire thing. Simpson was a very talented football player. He was a running back, and he was a very charismatic guy. He made a fortune not only playing football at the highest level and achieving massive salary there, but also the many endorsements that he made. Those endorsements then led to cameos and TV shows, and then he even began an acting career after he retired from football with a lot of movies. But the man had quite a temper. And when his ex-wife and her friend Brown were found brutally murdered, he was, of course, the prime suspect, and for very good reason. He had a history of domestic violence before he, before Nicole divorced him. The police were very familiar with his address. They'd been called there on multiple occasions for domestic violence. And so he had a history. He had financial motive to kill her. He had an anger problem with her. And so he had, as they say on all the cop shows, you know, he had motive, opportunity, and means. And his biggest problem, though, was the scientific evidence. Simpson's blood was found at the scene of the crime. His blood was there. The odds that it was not Simpson's blood were only 1 in 170 million. Was Simpson's blood. Number two, the blood of Ron Goldman, Nicole Brown, and O.J. Simpson were all found intermingled in Simpson's Bronco. The bloody left iris light glove found at the crime scene had blood from Goldman, Brown, and Simpson on it, and matched the right glove at Simpson's house. Simpson had been seen wearing that brand of gloves for years. The bloody footprints found at the scene and in Simpson's Bronco were from a rare type of Bruno Magali size 12 shoes that Simpson owned. They were rare. There were only 299 pairs of them sold in the entire United States. Brown's blood was on Simpson's socks. which had about 20 stains of blood. The blood had DNA characteristics that only 1 in 9.7 billion Caucasians would have, meaning Brown was probably the only person in the world that had that blood. Another lab put the number at 1 in 21 billion. That was the science that was presented in the trial and presented to the jury. Would you say that science says that he's guilty? This is the scientific data. But you see, science, Turek made a great point, did not put O.J. on trial. The state of California did. And the prosecutor was a dingbat. And she went up against, she was completely outgunned, and went up against what was probably the dream team of legal defense at the time. If science could have talked on its own, O.J. would have been found guilty. The scientific evidence logically points to that conclusion. All they had to do was realize that 1 in 21 billion meant he was there and he did it. His gloves were there, his shoes were there. The blood was intermingled of his and everybody else's, the two victims together, found on the scene in his Bronco and on his socks. But to Turek's point, and he isn't wrong, science doesn't interpret the data. Scientists do. And in this case, the scientists were the jurors. And this dream team of his put forth enough bias in that court case, enough, I don't want to go through the whole thing, but you know, basically they tried to say that all of that evidence was planted by the police department. For why, right? Why would they even do that? Later, OJ was sued by Nicole Brown's father and family, and was found guilty of causing the death of those two people. So one set of scientists interpreted data right, the other set interpreted the data wrong, and a murderer went free. The point here is that scientists can be biased as well. They can come to the analysis of scientific data with presuppositions that cause them to not follow the data because it doesn't align with their presuppositions. So a person's worldview can affect how he or she gathers and interprets evidence. And this was borne out in later on, about 6, 7, 8 years later, NBC did a poll, and they polled about 1,200 people and asked them if OJ was guilty or not. The survey showed that 87% of the whites said he was guilty. 29% of the blacks said he was not guilty. And that split is illustrative of the different worldviews that those people have because of the history of racism in our country. The blacks were more likely to believe that the police had concocted all of this evidence to frame OJ. That, you know, the cops are out to get the blacks, right? So they wanted, with that presupposition, they're bent then to say, okay, well, we'll ignore that evidence in light of what fits my presupposition, you see. And so they could be more readily convinced that these bumbling LAPD cops had somehow gathered up the motive, opportunity, and means to plant all that bloody evidence within minutes of the crime, that this whole police department was able to collude inside of a 5-minute period, that everybody had the same story and people were planting evidence in different places all at once. They could believe that because of a presupposition and a bias. So the statement that says science doesn't say anything, scientists do, is very important. Because the worldview that the scientist brings when he or she analyzes the data has an effect on how that data is interpreted. On the other hand, a theist is open to both material and immaterial causes. The presupposition that comes does not blind them to one side or the other. It allows the theist to follow the evidence where it leads. The atheist, on the other hand, is only open to material causes, which leads to ridiculous conclusions. Dr. Edward Fieser was once an atheist philosopher, but he's now a Christian apologist. He gave this illustration of how the limited materialistic worldview leads to absurd conclusions. He was living on the Jersey Shore, and he saw these men, you know, each morning during the during the high season, when everybody was out on the beaches. They would come out in the morning with their metal detectors, and they'd comb the beach looking for dropped jewelry or coins or what have you. They figured, hey, if I found one wedding ring or one diamond earring or something on the beach, it'd pay for the metal detector many times over. But you know, the thing about metal detectors, and this is his point, is they only find metal. Metal detectors only find metal. They don't find plastic, wood, glass, rubber. They don't find anything that isn't metal. So Dr. Fieser asks this question. He says, suppose metal detector man, after combing the beach, says to you, I know there's no plastic, no rubber, no glass on this beach because I've looked for things with my metal detector and I haven't found anything. You think, oh, that's nuts. But then he goes even further and he says, I can also say that there's not any plastic, any rubber, any glass anywhere because I've never found any of that stuff with my metal detector. Now you'd look at him and think, man, you're crazy. Because you're looking at him and you're looking at the metal detector and it has parts on it made of plastic and glass and rubber, and you think he's nuts. But Dr. Fieser says that metal detector man is just like the materialistic scientist that insists that all truth comes from science, from all truth will come from material things that science can discover. They assume that nothing but material things exist. But just like the metal detector man that doesn't realize that plastic and rubber are part of his detector, and in fact his detector wouldn't even work without them, so the materialistic atheist and scientist doesn't realize that his chosen tool, like the metal detector, doesn't work without the immaterial realities of some of the things we've talked about in this series. Logic, mathematics, reason, okay? And because science depends on these realities, they can't use science to prove whether they exist or don't exist. Atheists think science will prove that God doesn't exist. Think about that worldview for a minute. How can that be possible? If science only deals with natural causes, and God is not a natural cause to them, how can they expect their science of natural causes to prove that something that is not natural doesn't exist? It can't happen. Their detector is not tuned to anything supernatural, so it can't detect it or not detect it, one way or the other. A metal detector works great for finding metal, but that's all it does. And natural science works great to find natural causes, but that's all it does. Natural science is just one way of discovering truth. And to say that it's the only way is just plain false. We can learn or know truth from self-evident philosophical principles, like I've already mentioned, laws of logic and mathematics, the basic laws of morality, okay? We can learn or know truth through your senses. I mean, I don't know, call me crazy, but you don't need a test. You don't need a laboratory for you to deduct that there's a presentation in front of you on a television set. You have perception, right, through your senses. We can learn to know truth from introspection. You learn truths about yourself, don't you? You know if you're hungry, if you're tired, or if you're in love, or convicted, or doubtful, and you know, all of these things that we experience in our thoughts and our feelings directly. We learn or know truth from the testimony of others, from history, even from the present day, yesterday, now, right? We can learn or know truth from revelation, which is not only possible, but likely, right, if God exists, of course. Now, there's probably others that I've missed, but the point is here that there are two very distinct types of science, isn't there? There's what's called operational science and origin science. Operational science investigates repeatable questions, things that can be tested and repeated. Origin science investigates historical questions. Now, many refer to these as empirical science and forensic science. You know, we watch these cop shows, you see police detectives that use forensic science many times to solve crimes. They can't use empirical science to go into a lab to recreate the murder and then sit back and watch who did it, right? No, that's operational science. Forensic science uses forensic methods. They look for clues, and then they follow those clues and use logic, immaterial, and reason, immaterial, to guide that process. Okay, here's the problem that we have now. And hopefully we're teaching our young kids to make this, you know, it's great, you're homeschooling, but when they go into the schools, these two types of science are intermingled in that sense. The problem we have now is that the materialistic scientists, it's not willing to follow where the data is leading, because they have ruled out intelligence before they even start. Think about Romans chapter 1. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Made. Even his eternal power and Godhead, so they're without excuse. Because although they knew God, they can see God if they follow it. They didn't glorify him. In other words, they're not giving him the credit for it. They're not acknowledging him. They're not thankful. So they become futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they become fools. God says that he's known by what he has done, what he's made, the clues that he has left behind. In fact, he says that these clues are so huge, so blatantly obvious, that those that don't acknowledge them are without excuse. To disregard such huge clues, it says, is futile. And when that is done, it turns their hearts to darkness and they become fools. We read in Psalm 14 that the fool says in his heart, there is no God. By going into the questions of origin with the attitude that it has to be natural, that it can't be by design or by an outside intellect, by cutting out that possibility, before you even start, you are unable to follow the data to its logical conclusion. And that's what this is saying. So we see once again in God's Word that these words ring true. We can see them right in front of us in our society. Professing to be wise, they become as fools. If you don't believe me, watch a couple of debates. We watched one live last night. You'll see it. You'll see men sitting there and your heart just aches for them. They're professing to be wise. They act so haughty, like they are the only ones in the room with a brain. But they become fools. Because as some of these things are presented to them, they have no way to answer the questions. They just dodge them. There's no way to address the logic that the Christian apologists or even non-Christian intellectual design people, scientists, that submit to them. Even though all the data leads to intellectual design, they refuse. Their answers are circular and unreasonable. You can detect it. So as this scripture says, they refuse to glorify Him, to be thankful to Him. So their thoughts become futile. They're just futile. Hearts darkened and they sit as fools. And what is interesting to me is they admit it. Their hearts are so hardened that they're actually proud of it. That haughtiness comes forth. They're proud of it. They actually have a name for it. They call it methodological. Yeah, that's right. Methodological. But that's not how it's written. Anyway, they call it that, methodological naturalism. Maybe they can't say it either because it's known across the scientific world as just the rule. Look at what atheist Richard Lewontin of Harvard, he said this. He said, our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense, they're against common sense, is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and wealth, or health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. Why? Because we have a prior commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that naturalism or materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Admit it. He says he would rather accept patently absurd, unsubstantiated, just-so stories as an explanation of our phenomenal world rather than allow a divine foot in the door. Well, he's a fool. But at least he's honest about it. They just can't seem to accept that there might be something out there that's smarter than they are. But if we adopt the rule before we even look at the evidence, then we have no chance of coming to a right conclusion, and they don't. It's interesting, science, archaeologists are scientists in one field. They don't look at Mount Rushmore and think it was caused by erosion, do they? It's ridiculous. But you have scientists doing exactly that when they look at the origin of the universe. They ignore the fact that their founders, their founding fathers of their religion, of modern science, got its start by Christians. Men like Bacon, Galileo, Newton, Kepler, saw that there were laws that governed the universe, that they have a uniform, regular, and a consistency to them that could be tested. So they began to do that. And as they did that, they gave birth to modern science. They tested laws and they began to learn how to use them to make life better, to harness those laws, to understand the world around them. And that's how modern science was born. But these men also realized that those laws require a lawgiver. They saw science as a way to better understand that lawgiver. They saw God's attributes being displayed in what was made, like we read in Romans chapter 1. But many in modern science today, they don't do that. They think that God and the laws of nature are separate. It's a mistake that the founders of modern science would have never made. Here's a quote from the book here, Stealing from God. Turk says, as John Lennox put it, when Sir Isaac Newton discovered the universal law of gravitation, he didn't say, I've discovered a mechanism that accounts for planetary motion, therefore there's no agent God who designed it. Quite the opposite. Precisely because he understood how it worked, he was moved to increased admiration for the God who had designed it that way. The natural sciences have given us a lot in our modern world. We have iPad presentations and TVs to put them on and smartphones and cameras and heck, we put a man on the moon for crying out loud. And you need to understand some perspective here. What has that done in our society and around the world? What it has done is it has elevated science to a position of prestige. You understand that? And that's why this danger of this intermingling is so important. People these days will believe just about anything if science, the same science that gave them their cell phone, the same science that gave them this and that in our modern world, if anything, they'll believe hardly anything that science tells them. You know, if you don't believe this, if you've got cable TV or whatever, watch the Carbonaro effect. Watch a couple of those episodes. This magician gets out there and he does these things and he can get these people to believe just about anything. He does these magic tricks and gets people to... And it's all because of our scientific world. We've been programmed to think, gosh, just about anything's possible. So if science tells him, you know, this guy, he gets people to believe anything. So my point is that science has been elevated and risen to this position of prestige. But just like the metal detector, even though science is good at finding some things, it can't answer every question. And here's the point. Knowing how nature operates is not the same as knowing how nature originated. But the atheistic, materialistic scientists want you to believe that. Here's what they do. They take the prestige that modern scientific advances have given us, and they use that to make people think that it's that same science that their theories come from. And it's not. They lump the natural science, the empirical science, the operational science that has given us all of these technological advances, and they interject that prestige and standing into the discussions of origin and forensic science and call it all one science, and it's not. Again, from the book, Turek says, people like Lawrence Cross, Richard Dawkins, and Peter Adkins use this confusion to their advantage. When they falsely assert that God isn't necessary because science can explain everything, many of us think that since they're scientists, They must know what they're talking about. But they're confusing categories. They're using the prestige of operation science as cover for their guesses about how the world and life originated. Those guesses or speculations are not based on evidence, but are derived from their materialistic worldview. As we have seen, quite often their speculations are counterintuitive. They're against common sense and logically self-defeating. That's why John Lennox, a scientist himself, warns that statements by scientists are not necessarily statements of science. Nor, we might add, are such statements necessarily true, although the prestige of science is such that they are taken to be so. Again, natural science is great, but it doesn't explain everything. And these guys want to use the success of natural science to make you think that what they're serving up as the origins of the universe are drawn from the same successes as the natural science, and they're not. As believers, we don't object to natural science. In fact, we applaud it. We embrace it because it will always, when honestly looked at, lead us to God and make us even more aware of His greatness and His glory and His power and His intellect. It lifts Him up. Natural science is the study of God's handiwork. But as we've seen, it's only part of the picture. We don't throw it out, but we have our eyes open to the immaterial as well. And I'm talking again, I'm not talking about faith and all. I'm talking about reason and mathematics and logic. I'm a car guy, you guys know that, so I'm going to use another car illustration. Let's say you've got a Model T in front of you. Now this is interactive for you guys. I'm going to ask you, what accounts for the car? You got this Model T in front of you. What accounts for the car? How did it get there? Now, I'm going to give you two choices. You get two choices, but you only get one. You have to choose between the two, okay? Would you say that Henry Ford is responsible for getting the car there? Or, you only get one, would you say that the natural laws governing internal combustion and engineering got the car there? Now you only get one. Which one are you going to pick? I hope you realize right away that you need both of them. See, with naturalism, you just have the one, and it doesn't work. Because just all of those laws that are in existence, they don't create the Model T. You have to have Henry Ford, and you have to have the natural laws that he applied to make the car. And here's the point. No matter how much you come and study that car, you can know every nut and bolt, and you can know every single thing there is to know about that car. You can test that thing until eternity ends. And you'll never get away from the need to have somebody design and actually build the car. And so in the same way, our improved understanding of the natural laws and the natural world can never disprove the being that set it up and sustains those laws. To say that a scientist can disprove the existence of God is like saying a mechanic can come in and study that car and disprove the existence of the car company that made it. Frank says correctly here, the existence of secondary operational causes does not negate the need for a primary origination cause. Right? So we see that it's not God versus science. It's atheism versus science. Because the Bible has nothing to fear from science. I shared something with Mom before this morning before y'all got here. Remind me if you want, and I'll share something with you guys, discussion time, something pretty cool about science. We have nothing, the Bible has nothing to fear from science. Atheists will tell you that believing in God gets in the way of science. In fact, it's the other way around. By having the presupposition that everything is material, they're not allowed to follow the data to its correct conclusion, and so it's their religion is the one that gets in the way of science, not ours. And further, they would not even be able to do science without the things that God has provided outside the material. That's the point of the book. Again, think about the crimes, right? Scientists can't do their work without assuming that the law of causality and the orderly laws of nature are consistent. If there wasn't consistency, they couldn't gather data, they couldn't interpret data, they couldn't do any testing. They can't interpret the data without the laws of logic and the ability to reason, which are not material and they're not something they can test. Scientists demonstrate that information and intentionality are telltale signs of intelligence. And they do that when they freely intend to investigate a particular question, and then they fill their report with information intending to report their findings. And the immaterial realities of morality and evil impact science like any other human endeavor. We covered this. Science won't work if scientists fudge their data, right? In order to get the results they want. It's not moral. Okay? They can't produce honesty in a test tube. They have to be honest themselves, don't they? And while science can help us build a bomb, science can't tell us whether it's right or wrong to use the bomb. So they use what God has provided outside their materialistic worldview to try and establish that view. Yet they continue to try and maintain that all they need is the natural materialistic world. And it's futile, as Romans 1 told us. I want to show you right now a quick clip of a debate between William Lane Craig, I don't know if you guys know him, he's a pretty famous Christian apologist, and atheistic scientist, his name is Dr. Peter Atkins, he's a pretty famous atheist. To keep this short, Atkins, just only doing a very small portion of this, Atkins has just asserted this position, that all you need that there is the material universe, that there is no need for God to explain anything, and that everything can be explained by the natural materialistic universe. He has just presented and asserted that position, that science can account for everything. Dr. Craig then responds, and we'll pick it up right there, that he doesn't accept that. And it's very hard to catch in the video, but Atkins asks him then, what can science not account for? What can science not account for? That's what Atkins is asking him. And here's Dr. Craig's answer. And I want you to notice Atkins' face as this is presented to him.
Yes, I do deny that science...
So what can't it account for?
Well, had you brought that up in the debate, I had a number of examples that I was going to give. I think there are a good number of things that cannot be scientifically proven, but that we're all rational to accept. Let me list five. Logical and mathematical truths cannot be proven by science. Science presupposes logic and math, so that to try to prove them by science would be arguing in a circle. Metaphysical truths, like there are other minds other than my own, or that the external world is real, or that the past was not created 5 minutes ago with an appearance of age, are rational beliefs that cannot be scientifically proven. Ethical beliefs about statements of value are not accessible by the scientific method. You can't show by science whether the Nazi scientists in the camps did anything evil as opposed to the scientists in Western democracies. Aesthetic judgments, number four, cannot be accessed by the scientific method because the beautiful, like the good, cannot be scientifically proven. And finally, most remarkably, would be science itself. Science cannot be justified by the scientific method. Science is permeated with unprovable assumptions. For example, in the special theory of relativity, the whole theory hinges on the assumption that the speed of light is constant in a one-way direction between any two points A and B. But that strictly cannot be proven. We simply have to assume that in order to hold to the theory.
But you're missing the whole...
So put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah, all right. Okay.
What did he say? Put that in your pipe and smoke it. That was the other guy was William F.
Mediator.
Buckley. He was the mediator. And
doing a like, good job
put that. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. It's funny, when he introduced this, I watched this whole debate. And when he introduced him, you know, he gives a whole background about it. And he started with William Lane Craig and told all about his history, his PhD, blah, 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 blah. And then he goes... and then defending the side of the devil, and everybody laughed. But he's, you know, Buckley. I don't. You guys probably don't know much about him. He's pretty lively guy. Anyway, I thought it was interesting. I just wanted to share that with you. That you see this a lot. You know, you saw the stunned look on Atkin's face. And he had, I mean, you know, I could have played the whole rest of it. There was no answer for that. His face said it all. There's no answer for it. The claim that science can account for everything is just patently false. It's just false. But it's so hard for these people to accept because they are so enamored with their metal detector. Their metal detector has become their god. It's ironic. They claim that they can't allow a divine foot in the door because it would stop science. That religion would hinder science. And in a way, they have fulfilled their own prophecy. They're correct. Religion has hindered science. But it's their religion of materialism that has hindered science. Atheistic science have their belief systems. They try to, well, you know, we watched a debate last night, and they tried, this guy tried to say, listen, I'm not saying there is no God, I'm saying there's no way to prove it. They try to sidestep it by saying that, okay, it's your responsibility to prove it. I'm Switzerland. But that's not true. They have a belief system that says there is no God, and so their materialistic view will not allow them to go there. And when they say that life was not created by God, those are theological positions, people. They are not scientific discoveries. They're theological positions. Theological. It is a religion. And it is their religion that keeps them from following the scientific data. I want to read this. It's from Robert Gastow. He's a noted astronomer. And it's interesting because he's agnostic. And so he is kind of trying to be Switzerland. But he says this. He says, there is a kind of religion in science. And that religion is, every effect must have its cause. There is no first cause. That's a religion. This religious faith of the scientists is violated, though, by the discovery that the world had a beginning under conditions in which the known laws of physics are not valid. And as a product of forces or circumstances we cannot discover. See, when these truths are placed in front of these men and their religion is threatened, what do? They have answers? No. They go on the attack. Rather than accepting the data. Dawkins does this all the time. He did it in his book, The God Delusion. He resorted to, he calls anyone that disbelieves in evolution or believes in intelligent design, he resorts to name callings. They're stupid, they're ignorant, they're morons, insane. He's actually called them insane. It's in his book. So why all this vitriol? Why are intelligent design proponents within the scientific community ostracized, harassed, denounced, fired from their positions within the universities and stuff? Isn't this supposed to be science? No, it's not now. It's a religion. It's a false religion. So guys, when you hear someone say, science says, and then fill in the blank, don't believe it. Don't believe it. What you need to hear, what that we're really saying, is a scientist has said something, and then you need to evaluate it. Did that scientist base this on operational science where something has been tested and proven and it is a fact, or is it coming from his religion, from his worldview? Because if it is, it's likely wrong, and it's just a product of his opinion rather than any sort of evidence. Turek puts it this way. Due to the technical nature of origin questions and the prestige of science, we often take a scientist's conclusions on authority. But too often, atheists are feeding us materialistic philosophy stuffed in a dress of science. So let me try and sum this up. First of all, science doesn't say anything. Scientists do. There is no disagreement with empirical science from the Christian worldview. We don't disagree with that. We embrace it. Okay? We only have a disagreement on the forensic side when there's a worldview that presupposes that intelligent design does not exist. Intelligent design is open to both material and immaterial sources when following the data. But materialistic atheists are not open to both. They're using a metal detector that only detects metal. This leads to counterintuitive, as they even agree with, absurd stories that go against common sense. Now the big story, because there's a big bang, and because now we know that time and matter and all of this didn't exist, that all of their things are gone. Now there's multiple universes. Have you heard this one? That there's like billions and trillions of them, and we just happen to be in the one that supports life. Counterintuitive, absurd stories. This isn't science. Science can't use just a metal detector and believe that they can find all truth. I hope you get that point. God and science aren't competing explanations any more than Henry Ford and the laws affecting internal combustion are for the explanation of the Model T. They're not in conflict. You need both. Materialistic scientists can only do science when stealing immaterial realities from God. So there you have it. I want to end with the last quote in this chapter from Turek. Oh, I forgot this one. Intelligent design is not a science stopper. So we're not the ones stopping science. They are materialism. But here's his last. This is how he closes out his chapter here. Science, rightly understood, can point us to our Creator, he says, who has the answers. But we will never find the answers by merely studying and manipulating molecules. We won't get far by glorifying repetitive secondary causes while refusing to glorify the primary cause sustaining it all. Such a stunted and false view of reality seeks to give us more to live with, but it actually gives us nothing to live for. And I'll conclude with one more quote from another book, and then we'll huddle up. Again, it's by Robert Jastrow, the guy that I've told you about, the agnostic astronomer. He wrote a book called God and the Astronomers. And again, he's agnostic. Bear that in mind. He wrote this. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. In other words, he's figured everything out. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. So let's huddle up. Talk about it. Amen?